Aloha, mahalo.
Oh, right, right. We got to do our regional greetings.
Yes, because I'm in exotic Los Angeles.
Hmm. That is a wonderful, wonderful city of angels.
Yeah, hopefully nobody ever blows it up.
especially not aliens.
They didn't
blow up Hawaii, of all places, so it must be a very serene, comfortable place for people to hang out.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of people, so if they're targeting population centers and cities of political import, then I could see why they'd pass it by for the time being. But, I mean, I have to imagine they'd eventually get there.
Hmm. But you enjoyed your pineapples and palm trees?
I did. And my I did a hike. I did one of those. which, I don't know if you're familiar, but you can go outside, and they have these trails where there's, like, some sand and stuff and some dirt. Maybe a little mud here and there. And you have to walk on it for, like, a really long time. Sometimes you can see something pretty. Other times there's just bugs. So I did that.
Sometimes there's some bugs.
Yeah. Well, this is a true story. There were bugs.
Yeah, there are bugs. I am familiar. That's mm-hmm. why I don't go outside all that often. There are a lot of bugs here.
Yeah. But it was pretty. So that was kind of a payoff.
You consumed tropical fruits in both solid and liquid form?
Yes. That's not a euphemism. But I had there were these drink things, you know, and they put stuff in it. It's mostly sugar, and fruit juice, and then a lot of rum and stuff. So those were good. Although I could have like one of those, and then I would be like, okay, so I'd like to move on to like a beer or something where it's not as like saccharine. Let's say. Because the sweetness factor was just sort of overwhelming.
They didn't have beer there at all?
Oh, they did. I had a... as a matter of fact, I'm drinking some now, which I did not bring myself, but rather came in bottles that were available at a store here, which the Kona Big Wave Golden Ale. So there's that. It tastes better when you get it, you know, on draft at a pool bar and then can lounge. Than when you are in your stifling apartment. So, you know, and you open it up with a bottle opener and it just goes glug, 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 and then it just sort of fizzes a little and doesn't taste as good.
It's just because you don't have any view of palm trees out your window, do you?
No, I can see the other apartment building.
Is it a nice looking apartment building?
Not usually. I do keep my blinds closed, so maybe it's suddenly better, but... I'm guessing no.
My apartment in Tucson actually used to have palm trees painted on the side, so that would kind of be like a good halfway point for you.
Yeah, but you couldn't see them.
Well, if you were in the apartment building across the street, you could see the palm trees painted on my building.
So I could appreciate your building if I lived next door to you, if we were neighbors.
Yeah, it was yellow and really old and smelled a little funny, but it had palm trees on it.
Well, I wouldn't have to deal with the smell, but the yellow, I'm not so fond of yellow.
No, it was mostly that part of the city that actually smelled, so you would have to deal with that, unfortunately.
Oh, that's an interesting attribute. I hadn't really taken it into consideration.
Yeah, it's Tucson. What are you going to do?
Not be in it anymore. Congratulations, Dan. You're not
Thank
in Tucson.
Thank you. I was very proud of escaping there.
Mm-hmm. Why were you there in the first place?
College.
That's where you went and you learned your skills and mastered your trade, your craft.
It's where I went to some math classes and didn't go to some other math classes and pretended to be an engineer for a little while.
Mm.
Anyway.
Yes.
I didn't in a similar fashion, I did squander my engineering education, but I didn't go work for a cable broadcasting company. I came and made videos.
That's close enough. Although you're not gonna...
Was that a Joe quality segue or no?
Close enough. It's not that important that you necessarily fix cable anymore because that's really going down. It's more about streaming video. So you could detect a signal hidden in the transcoding of...
You know what I couldn't detect a signal in?
Mm-hmm.
My freaking Apple TV rental again.
Oh.
I did it again.
Did you rent on another device and then try to view it on the TV?
Or See,
did... Do you do it right on the TV?
I knew what I was getting into. I rented it on the laptop. I'm like, you know what? If all else fails, I'll airplay it from the laptop to the TV like I've done before, which is fine. I've done that before. I've had to do it, and it's fine. And I downloaded it ahead of time, so I didn't have those streaming problems. But I'm in iTunes 12.2 now with my fancy Apple Music, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, where is the AirPlay button? It is non-existent. I go over to my Apple TV, and it's not doing anything. The rental's not there, of course, so I'm just going to go stream it. So I reboot my laptop, still no AirPlay button, because apparently it doesn't appear until you have an AirPlay device to AirPlay to. So I had to reboot my laptop, then reboot the Apple TV so they could see each other on AirPlay. Then I got the AirPlay button, and then I could turn that on, and then it took like 10 seconds to buffer, and then it worked fine after that. But I had to reboot both things, and just like the fact that you don't even see the AirPlay button until there is a connection in the background that you have no idea why it's not working, it's just the best thing ever.
It's exciting.
It's very exciting.
I didn't make that mistake.
Well, I did it on purpose too. I knew what I was getting into. I'm just going to AirPlay it from the laptop. I had the local download here because I assume I'm probably going to watch it in the living room because Amanda usually wants to watch it with me, even though I always plan for her not wanting to watch it. So anyway, I eventually watched it on my television, streamed from my laptop.
Okay. Well, just so you know, it's also like $10 right now, so I just went ahead and bought it.
Yeah, it was $4 to rent.
Yeah, so it's 40% of the cost of buying it.
But both of those options seemed like ripoffs since it was on TV like literally 2 days ago.
I know. Oh, that's another thing to point out. hey guys, remember Independence Day? Listeners?
The day or the movie?
The both of them, because they probably watched it when I was on TV during Independence Day. Well, Dan and I, since we're recording on glorious July the 7th, are reliving the hot dog halcyon days. And, you know, family barbecues and whatnot, where we are doing that whole thing.
The salad days, as they said in the news broadcast when they were making fun of the president.
Yes, yes. Because they're making fun of his age, and he was a Gulf War pilot. Not that that's important. If you put a Gulf War pilot on the mantle in the first act.
Chekhov's love Gulf War pilots?
Oi. So this movie, do we want to, where should we start at the beginning, or should we skip past like the first 20 minutes or like,
the first 20 minutes where, one of our main characters isn't even addressed?
Yes. I noticed that too, which is why I specifically mentioned 20 minutes. 20 minutes is when we get, Will Smith in the movie. Before that, we have, the president being the first main character introduced, the first lady, who is a secondary character at best, and the daughter, who is like tertiary to the whole thing. Then there's Jeff Goldblum and Connie, who we don't know is actually important or not, other than the fact that she's overacting in her first scene that she's in, which at least I felt she was hamming it up something awful. And so we have them established pretty quickly. Harvey Fierstein is established, but he has a brief existence. And then we have
he's the guy with the voice.
Yes, the guy with the voice.
The guy with the voice. I don't know a better way to describe him.
Yes, yes. The flamboyant, short, kind of pudgy Jewish man who sounds like he smokes a lot and was, you know, complaining to David all the time. David, why did I just send my mother to Atlanta? So
you can't even do it as gravelly as he does.
No, I can't, because I don't smoke. But the but you know, there's all that stuff that's happening, and then even in the first scene of this, there are no characters at the beginning of this movie, and then the characters that we first get are the SETI guys who don't factor into the film at all.
You know, my favorite thing about the SETI scene that I didn't notice until now is he calls the guy who's ostensibly in the other room like 20 feet away from him. Did you notice that?
Well, I couldn't figure it out at first because I was like, wait, is he sleeping in a bunk there? And then I was just wondering, like, how important is SETI? Like, really? Like,
They're like doctors on call 24 hours a day?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, oh no, get somebody down here stat. We've got another alien.
It had to be that he was sleeping in the other room because he's still putting on his robe, like, as he walks into the control center. It's like, if you drove in from home, wouldn't you have put that on when you got out of bed?
I don't know. They probably filmed it in the room next door. And of course, we have a character actor who enters here who was in Roland Emmerich's preceding film, Stargate, which I'm sure we'll talk about one of these days because I kind of like it, even though it's cheesy and bad. But he makes his appearance here, and
isn't he also the guy from Mr. Deeds?
Could be. I don't think I've seen Mr. Deeds. But they have your lucky stars. Okay, and there's REM's End of the World, as we know it, playing, which is funny because guess what? LOL, End of the World, and that establishes some of the plot devices of the film, and all of the characters are sort of introduced in sort of a haphazard, like in the middle of their life, they're just caught off guard by what's happening, kind of a way. And so that's why the president's all talking about his presidential stuff, and we establish the kid, and that she shouldn't stay up all night, and that the wife always calls him a liar, which is funny. and the wife, of course, is Mary McDonnell, who I quite like as an actress, and I think that she plays very well as a first lady type figure in this film, although her bangs are kind of out of control.
It was the, what was it now?
Style at the time, so Mary McDonnell's in here, and she plays the first lady. She would go on after this to play the president of the colonies, Laura Roslin, in a little thing called Battlestar Galactica. So there's that.
So we've moved on from you pointing out Star Trek actors to Battlestar Galactica actors.
I would just say that we have expanded the final frontier.
All the space properties are actors you're going to point out?
Yeah, I have a plan. So they have.
I'm going to go ahead and guess that was a Star Trek reference.
No, it wasn't.
Damn it.
This is the best part.
It's not the best part.
Some of our listeners are like this. Some. But the. they have their little thing, and very. We start to get the sense that he's kind of not entirely authoritative and competent in his role as president. And Connie, of course, is very critical of him, and he's very critical of her. And we get wonderful Jeff Goldblum and Judge Hirsch playing chess, and they are father and son, even though the age difference is kind of small between them. and so Judd Hirsch had to get his like hair dyed gray and, you know, play up the old in order to really convey the fact that he was the father, but he does a very good job. I quite like Judd Hirsch in this movie, and they have their little chess game, and we get a couple of nice little character moments that set up their relationship and the marriage. We don't, of course, know who he was married to yet, but if you put a wedding ring on the mantle in the first act,
every bit of this film is just so intercut back and forth that. You know everything is just going to tie together an hour and 40 minutes into the movie when everyone comes together in the same room for some reason.
Oh, except Harvey Firestein. But,
well.
Yeah. So, poor Harvey. So they...
I mean, for $300 an hour, you can put him through to his house in the Hamptons.
Yes, exactly.
I like to think that the call went through. I'm an optimist.
Yes, Dan.
Are you okay?
Yes. But 20 minutes into the film, this very long film, we get, but it, you know, I mean, it doesn't feel long, I would say. Like, it's pretty, it's actually kind of like in terms of pacing, it's pretty snappy, given the amount of stuff that's happening. I don't feel like anything really like super drags here. And we don't even get all of our first characters, like we've said, until 20 minutes in. We get Will Smith and Vivica A. Fox and a kid. And
well, the weird thing about that is you get like two shots of him and the kid, and then they don't cut back to him until like 25 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, well, that's because they have to establish the flying saucer cloud. So There's that.
Cloud Tank.
Yes, Cloud Tank with lights.
Back when visual effects were handmade with cameras and not computers.
Well, actually, there's computers in this movie. But
there are a lot of computers in this movie.
Yes,
but there's also Cloud Tank's models.
Yes, lots of models. Tons of models. Because this was at that phase where digital compositing was starting to come in, the whole idea of actually using models was still very much a thing, because otherwise it would still kind of look like The Last Starfighter.
Yeah, there was some dicey blue screen, and I think the one thing that they did not use a model for that maybe they should have used a model for was Air Force One.
Yeah, well, also, when they had the explosions, which we'll get to. Whenever they had the explosions, they slowed them down in order to make them feel larger. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes those explosions would feel steppy. I'm assuming that they slowed some of those down post the way they recorded it. But because sometimes you'd watch something and you would see like almost like a stuttering through it in some of these explosion effects. Other ones seemed smoother, so it seemed like they shot those in actual slow-mo versus, like, slowing down their slow-mo. But the, it was imperfect. Although, you know, for its day, you know,
great.
It was
phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't notice any steppiness, but I did notice some potentially realistic transparency, especially on the edges of some of the fire and smoke elements.
Oh, yeah. And especially when they had some of the things like colliding against the alien ships and the fighters and stuff, there's a lot of messy stuff in there. If you look, you'll find like little dark edges around things. I don't know all the details, but not all perfect, shall we say?
No, I mean there's some like some of the shots where they're shooting down the streets and seeing the large buildings explode. There's some model stuff that doesn't have quite the same black levels and maybe some dicey matte lines for the blue screen or whatever, but it all is still really good. The only thing that stuck out to me is like almost laughable when I saw it was, did you notice when they first, well, when they take off in the alien craft, like way down the line in the third act, when they fly up through the clouds are just like a 2D element that have no depth and they just like, they don't even, because it's a complex camera move, but the clouds are just kind of like this flat plane that kind of moves in 3D space a little bit.
Yeah, it didn't really bother me that much. What bothers me more is when the alien puppet is stomping around in the vault, and they have the tentacles all flailing around behind it, and it doesn't really look right. Like they're
what
they're,
part?
Well, it doesn't. It feels like they shot like a miniature puppet of the alien, rather than like the alien, because like the tentacles are all flailing around like crazy. It looks very cut out and weird. If you look at that one,
I thought that was just somebody jiggling some cables to make the guy flail. Like it didn't look like he had necessarily the appropriate weight on his feet. But other than that, I thought he was okay.
Oh well, the weight thing, yeah, was not right, because they were obviously holding up with wires, because there's no way that those little knuckle things were working. And those wires gave way when he flew across the room after being shot. But
because that's how bullets work.
That's totally how bullets work. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
But there is a surprising amount of realism in this movie in terms of both plot and just like character reactions. I mean, there is some. There's some dicey acting moments in this movie, but in general, just, you know, the rapid pace of how everything just kind of falls apart and everything just happens. And like, there isn't really a plan and humanity just kind of scrambling around in these first few minutes. It all sort of plays relatively honestly, like the way people would actually react.
Yeah. Well, there's also, because of the limitations of the technology, there's a lot more of the old style of editing around the action, where you would get reaction shots to an effect that would be inserted later in a totally separate shot. So you don't you had to play up tension in a different way, because there wasn't going to be a CG element in your shot that you were in. Hmm. Like the floor wasn't going to fall away with, you know, there wasn't going to be a green screen behind them that we replaced with a fiery explosion. Like, there were a lot of characters looking off screen or looking kind of like three quarters, you know, off screen. And then they would cut to something happening, like an explosion or a fireball or something like that. But there wasn't usually stuff happening in the frame with them most of the time, because that was very expensive. And so that it kind of has a different feel to it than if you watch like a modern movie, or especially like a modern Roland Emmerich movie, where there's just like CG out the wazoo and stuff's exploding nonstop. And it's not the fact that you're using computers that makes it bad. It's just the fact that there's you've coded everything and not real. So there's nothing really grounded. But in this, you have these reaction shots where I think it actually kind of works for the most part. I mean, sometimes they're like looking off screen and they're like, oh, and then there's like the most dangerous, horrible thing happening. And you cut back to them and they're just like, oh. And so they're not always like able to convey appropriately like the terror that they should be probably feeling.
Yeah, but, there was totally one where the White House staff first came out because they saw the ship settling over the city. And they said, you know, like, what do we do now? And the president said, we address the nation. There's going to be a lot of scared people. And what's her name? Connie? It says Constance. She went by Connie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
She leans in and goes, I'm one of them or whatever. But that's one where they shoot the reaction shot separate from the ship shot with the shadow coming over the city. And I just like picture them like they're just looking right over the camera. Somebody's probably dangling like a spaceship for their island. Like, look here at the spaceship on a stick. And it's just like, all right, this is scary. This is frightening, but it's also a little bit of a humor moment here. So I watched that scene knowing full well that they're just staring at some guy with a stick, and it kind of made me laugh a little bit.
Yeah. Or it was just like a piece of gaffer tape on a wall. But
I like to think they went through the trouble of having like a little bit of a spaceship to dangle in front of them.
Well, maybe. But it's a different way of making a movie. And it's certainly not the same way that Roland Emmerich makes his movies nowadays. And it's certainly not the way you're going to find most action movies made. So
I like the way he made this movie.
I like the way he made this movie, too. I think that people would do well to really look at the shots as they happen, especially during the initial destruction scenes, when everything is happening in all of the cities and we're cutting back and forth. I think that editing there works really well at building tension. We don't linger on anything long enough where we're just like, they're just people reacting to nothing happening. And we don't linger on any of the effects long enough to be like, this is a model exploding. Except for, I would say, maybe the Capitol building is, because I don't know, it had something to do with the way they were kind of like blowing it out from the side instead of from inside. But it's not as effective as the White House. Now, the White House explosion, which is iconic, and everyone remembers the White House explosion from this movie. It was used in all the marketing materials for the film. It's used in all of the marketing for the, you know, digital sales of this. It's used for the marketing whenever they have it on TV. It's used for like everything uses that. Like everyone is familiar with the White House blowing up in this film. And it is a model. You can watch behind the scenes like how they did it. It's very interesting to see. It's all pyrotechnics. They built the whole thing, wired it all up. It explodes in a certain way. They shot it slow motion. And they did it at a certain time of day outside. It's really interesting. But the thing with that is it's only on screen for 5 seconds, a grand total of 5 seconds. Now, imagine a big set piece like that in a modern film only on screen for 5 seconds, and that's it. And they use it for all the marketing materials and everything. It wouldn't happen. You'd have a flying camera move in through the White House as it exploded, people dodging.
Chasing somebody down a hallway?
Yeah, as people dodged fireballs. It would go for like, you know, 2,800 frames or something like that. Like, something ridiculous. Nowadays, people are thinking about that stuff differently. But if you think about like how that was done back then, it's so effective because it's 3 seconds. The thing blows up. It does what it says it's going to do on the tin, and that's it. it's not. There's no flying camera move. There's no crazy, time speed up ramp thing, like Zack Snyder style. Nothing crazy is happening. It is an explosion of the White House, and so it really can stick with you, even though it is so short, relatively speaking, in terms of the actual length that you see it.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I mean, it's kind of the opposite of last week, where We spent 30 seconds having a dinosaur escape and an hour and a half watching it eat everybody.
Yes, that would be another example to contrast with modern filmmaking, where Jurassic Park, if you look at the original, mostly reaction shots to things happening off screen. And sometimes there are puppets in the screen that the actors are reacting off of, but those puppets couldn't really move around, so they wouldn't actually like have them linger in the scene long, because then you'd realize the raptor was standing perfectly still.
I did rewatch Jurassic Park this weekend, and man, is that a good movie. Like, just it's so good in every way.
It's very good. Like, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't hold up and is a little weird, and there's some big plot holes and blah 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 blah, whatever. I don't care. And you know, you get to see a much younger B.D. Wong with a much smaller role and who doesn't ham it up as much. I saw the Jurassic Park waterfall when I was in Kauai, where they filmed this thing. I was on a helicopter.
Yeah.
It was a real waterfall. And now, modern day, you wouldn't use a real waterfall. Just kidding. Maybe they would have. Location scouting is important.
Those real folks simulations take a really long time to process.
Yeah. Well, that's why you hire Scanline. But, because they do water stuff. Audience, get with it.
I think they kind of inferred that, but that's really far inside baseball.
Yes, very. Yes, with the baseball.
Sports.
It's about tribalism or xenophobia, but
it is my favorite Huey Lewis album. Actually, no, I like his greatest hits.
I'm gonna line my living room floor with newspaper the next time you come over, and play some Huey Lewis for you. But so the thing that happens here, is we establish all of our characters, and we establish Randy Quaid, the crop duster who was abducted by aliens,
there's a blithering drunk.
Yes, and his kids who, I don't know if the mother left or died. I'm assuming left, because this doesn't seem like a stable situation. But for whatever reason, the kids are by themselves. And
there a reason they're in this movie?
To give some character buildingness for Randy Quaid.
To make it a little sad when he blows up?
Yeah. Because, I mean, I know what you're saying, though, because I'm not fond of the oldest of them. Gosh, Dad. Gosh, dusted the wrong field, Russell.
It's like Keanu Reeves' half-brother from Bill and Ted.
Yeah, and you know, then there's... what's his face? The other kid.
The one who throws up?
Yes. Who, I swear, I thought was, for a second, Third Rock from the Sun guy.
No, I don't think so.
No. For a second, I did. And then there's the teenage daughter. Again, we don't really get a sense of why they're in this film, other than you could say that the older son is established to be like the one who's actually taking care of everybody and holding everyone together, and he's the responsible one who has to step in because his dad isn't there, to be there for the family. And the dad is finally going to step up and fix things by the end of the film, but, you know, whatever. They're not as important to the film overall as some of the other characters. Randy Quaid is memorable, but mostly for his volume and his his sort of outlandish behavior, which is also something he's famous for in real life. So there's that.
Getting drunk and flying biplanes around and dusting the wrong person's crops?
No, weirder stuff than that. Go Google Randy Quaid.
You know, every time you tell me to go Google an actor, it really turns out poorly, so I'm not sure I want to do that.
No. Randy Quaid has had an interesting, if somewhat disappointing and scary life. So there's that. And the situation here is, of course, that he's drunk and he can't operate, and that he feels traumatized by what would appear to be a fictitious encounter with aliens that he had about 10 years ago where he feels like he was abducted. Although the movie doesn't really come right out and say it, it doesn't seem likely that it occurred. Or if it did, it didn't seem likely. It would be these particular aliens.
Yeah, they didn't seem the abducting type.
No, not so much. And especially... And we get like the sort of the Rocketeer airport bar, only it's with real some real jerks, and you know there's all that, and then they're making fun of him about the alien stuff. Again, this is more of like a natural and organic way to do the exposition, which is somewhat surprising given the amount of exposition they need to do to set up all of these characters. The fact that they take so long to spell out exactly how he's related to the kids and the fact that he's doing this stuff because he's drunk and then the fact that he's having trouble dealing with things because he feels like he was abducted and that the other guys are making fun of him, and then the alien ship comes in right on cue. Like,
while the pacing of this movie isn't super slow, like you said, it does take its time with things. It doesn't feel rushed in a way that if this movie were made today, it would certainly have been.
Well, they probably would have had like fewer characters, or at least fewer that we had any backstory for.
I mean, you could just recut this whole movie and just lose 2 seconds off every shot and just make the dialogue more Sorkin-ish and squish everything together, and you would lose probably 15 minutes out of the whole thing.
Yeah. Just more walk and talks. So
why not?
Yeah, crop dusting and talks. So they have this, and then they, you know, establish that the ships are coming in and they're settling over the major cities. The AWAC plane is destroyed by one of the ships, very dramatically with the fireball and stuff.
Yeah, that was. Why are the ships surrounded by fire, like, for a little while?
Because heat from reentry.
But they're not moving very quick.
Well, they're very big, so they feel like they're not moving very quick.
It's
like if you watch a freighter on the ocean. It's moving very fast, but it looks like it's moving very slow, because it's very big and it's very far away.
Yeah, I'm not sure that a large spaceship, even moving fast, would create projectile fireballs, but what do I know?
I don't know. Well,
I'm not a fireball spaceologist.
Okay. But the whole like cloud thing makes a little less sense, because it's not like they're burning something off of the ship which would expel a gas like that.
Maybe it's coal powered. Maybe that's why they're coming to Earth to harvest the coal.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why they're locusts going from planet to planet. They run out of coal for their steamships.
Yeah. They use telepathy and they have advanced spaceship technology, but it all just runs on coal.
Yes.
It's like legacy code. You can't get all the way down to the core of it and replace all of it. You just got to build on top.
Yes, yes. This is your wrought iron steampunk metal aliens. Yeah.
Or maybe it's just a lot of condensation. When it hits the atmosphere, it creates clouds.
Sure.
You know, maybe they're fond of their saunas and steam baths on the spaceship there.
Oh, and then they're like, oh no, everybody, gotta buckle up and sit down. No one in the steam baths and saunas. We gotta vent those into the atmosphere now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Return your tray table and your sauna to the upright and locked position.
Mm-hmm. So they do that, and they get into the atmosphere, and then they hover over the cities. They hover very specifically over certain iconic buildings in the cities that they settle over. The only ones that we really see clearly of the alien ships that have settled over the Earth are the one in Washington over the White House, which is not even the tallest building. The one in New York over the Empire State Building, again, not the tallest building. So I don't know why it's like virtually touching that little like round bulbousy dish part that opens, because it would mean like the Twin Towers are like scraping the bottom of it. There's the U.S. Bank Building, which I think is called the Library Building in downtown L.A., and that one is actually the tallest building. So kudos for them for that one. I don't think you can go up with placards and like wave them at aliens, but
No, they don't just have like a metal staircase that you can run up the side of?
No, I don't think so. I think it would take you'd probably be a little out of breath if you did that. But they have all of these establishing shots, and they're all just sitting there. And this whole time, David is working in his cable office building. There's a little throwaway line when he gets in, and the guy is like, "Yes, ma'am, I know. I like to watch the X-Files, too." And it's like, LOL. Oh,
that guy was terrible.
LOL the 90s. LOL Fox. But and they have the Fruitopia vending machine.
I must have missed that.
Oh, God, the Fruitopia vending machine's so good. The Fruitopia vending machine, everyone wearing plaid flannel shirts is just, it's just amazing. So good. And so they have all of this stuff happening, and, you know, David's oblivious to it, and he figures out it's a signal that's counting down, which I don't know why he would have, or if that is the case, why the aliens would have programmed it that way, because that seems like a really terrible way to do that. Just like, what are we going to do? I don't know. Let's have some really obvious counting mechanism instead of, you know, like SSH or something. Like, they can't encode anything? Like, encryption's not like a big deal for them? So they go through this whole thing of establishing their superiority by having a cycling counting clock mechanism that David can figure out in like 5 minutes. And then they...
Well, it's because he went to MIT.
Yes.
He's smart.
Yes. Unlike anyone else in the movie who doesn't figure this out. So, I don't know. It's weird. And they, you know, he tells everybody they should get out of town, that it's a counting clock, blah, 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 blah. He goes to his dad, and he's like, we need a car, so we need to go to D.C. because I need to save Connie. And, you know, he has the failed call with Connie to try to get her to leave the White House. And this, of course, establishes how they are connected. They go in their little car drive. Some nice character moments again for Judd Hirsch. And they get to DC. And of course, Jeff Goldblum uses his PowerBook 5300C with CD-ROM drive and the mini CD-ROM disk of a phone book of all of the numbers that are publicly listed in the US. To get Connie's number, and then use his satellite dish, which is hooked up by wires to his 5300C, so that he can triangulate her position in the White House. Let me explain something about triangulation.
That's not how it works.
What one point of reference is not triangulation. Unless he set those things up in two other positions that are off camera somewhere, no triangle has occurred. This is not triangulation.
He's using the cell towers.
Yes, exactly, because he has access to those, because they're probably on the same countdown timing software as the alien ship is.
I just love that she's like, how does he do that? Nowadays, it's just like, well, it's an app. It's called Find My Friends. But yeah, sure.
Find My Friends. I love her phone, too. And the fact that she's given like one of those like cordless Sony phones that's like 5 pounds. And she holds it up to her head. Yeah.
Did you see his, how it was like attached to the screen, the back of the screen of his laptop as like his modem?
Yes. Oh, it's so good. So amazing technology.
It's a good thing Goldblum is so tall, because it makes the laptop look almost normal sized.
Well, it's not so much the size of the laptop as it is the thickness. It's the girth. So they do the whole thing there of he, you know, cons Connie into letting him into the building with his dad. And they, you know, he tells her stuff.
I like that how he tricked her. He's like, he surprises her by showing up, and then surprises her again by like knowing exactly what window she's in. And apparently he's like, oh, he's real clever. I guess I should let him into the White House now instead of like go outside and yell at him through the fence and see what he wants.
Or have security drag him away.
Sure.
She's just like, I give up. You're too smart for me, Jeff Goldblum. And he comes in, and they have their little conversation, and she's like, I immediately believe you, because this seems credible. And so she goes off, she fetches the president, and we establish the fact that Jeff Goldblum and her might have had some trouble in their relationship, because he had punched the president previously the last time he saw him. And he stresses the point that he wasn't actually the president back then when he punched him.
You punched the president?
Yes.
He wasn't the president. But you punched the president?
Yeah.
We got that a couple times.
Yeah. But it was good. And they, you know, Bill Pullman comes in, and he reacts appropriately.
He reacts appropriately. I'm not sure there are more than maybe two instances where Bill Pullman reacts appropriately.
Yeah, well, he I don't know, seems upset and then calms down immediately. What do you want?
He's always got a little bit of a squinty smile going on in this movie.
Well, I think that's just, I think that's just default.
Bill Pullman.
That's just what happens when you turn your Bill Pullman on. It's the boot screen. And so he saunters in and they have the whole thing and he shows them the timer thing and he's like, oh, well, I got my stupid Close Encounters helicopter going up. I should go watch that. And they watch that thing go up. It's a little light show. Dun, 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 except kaboom, didn't work. I don't know why the aliens felt they had to destroy the little messenger ship instead of just let it do its thing, because that tipped their hand. So
it's like, he was already trying to pull him away, because once he saw the timer, he believed, but there wasn't enough time to get the helicopter away from the ship.
No, I know, but I don't know why the aliens still shot it.
Because they could. I don't know. Maybe they knew. Maybe they knew that they knew. He knew that they knew.
You know? All right. Yeah. So, well, I guess we know. But we don't know that they know, but we know enough to know that it doesn't matter. So we're moving on from this point, and we established that the timer, probably real. Aliens, probably dangerous. Get out of the White House. And so they scramble to get everyone out of the White House. That is important. Plus Jeff Goldblum and his dad. And then a bunch
of staffers important.
Die.
If it wasn't for him, nobody else would be alive.
Yes, yes. If it wasn't for my David. Everybody else dies. All the staffers, the guy who locked the latch on the helicopter, all dead.
Well, you kind of know what you're signing up for when that's your job.
It's kind of amazing, the trail of dead bodies that the president leaves behind him in this movie. Just because there's so many people who are like trying to help in service, like the actual people who are important to the film, but they drop like flies.
Well, as General Robert Loggia says, we have to maintain a working government. Sorry, we have to maintain a working government.
Yes, that was a good Robert Loggia. That was the best Robert Loggia.
He just furrows his brow and he just gets angry the whole movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's default Robert Loggia.
My God, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, NORAD. Was that better?
That was amazing. Remember him in Scarface?
Well, of course.
Yes, that was a good movie. So we have all that happening. They get out of there and they have James Rebhorn, who was I don't know if he ever plays somebody who isn't like a sniveling, horrible man, but he does it so well every time he does it. He's in so much stuff. He's unfortunately no longer with us, but he was a very famous character actor. He was in tons and tons of stuff. And so he plays this sniveling guy who's sort of pushing around the president in most of this film until everyone realizes maybe we shouldn't listen to him. And they get out of there on Air Force One, big explosion. For some reason, Vivica A. Fox went in to pick up her paycheck at work. Doesn't make any sense. Decided to go work.
Well, I mean, just because there's a spaceship hovering over the city doesn't mean you can't go to work and make some money.
Well, yes, it does. It really does. I don't know why any business would be open.
You would call in sick that day?
Not only would I call in sick, I have to imagine the person running the business would call in sick. Like, I don't see why that needed to be open. Like, what were they thinking? Like, oh, everyone's going to be so scared they want to see exotic dancing. So I
think that is some logic that would probably go down.
She complains to her friend, fellow coworker that, you know, she can't believe she got talked into working that day. And the friend, fellow coworker reveals a sign and it's like, oh, promise me you won't go up there. I got a really bad feeling about this. She's like, I promise. Of course she does. But then the next time we see Vivica A. Fox, she's leaving work, presumably, in normal clothes, and she has her kid and the dog, and they're driving from downtown Los Angeles. So she must have worked in downtown Los Angeles because they lived somewhere where they could see downtown Los Angeles, which kind of maybe was, I don't know, Los Feliz, or I don't know where they were. They were up high enough that they could look down upon downtown. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that she would drive to work underneath that thing and with her kid and with the dog, then drop them off, I guess, at a daycare or something, which was also somehow open, or leave them in like a break room at the strip club. Like, none of this seems like a good thing. And then they get back in the car and they're driving away back to the house or something. Like, because there's no reason why they would have driven through downtown on their way out of the city. That's not how it works. But there they are in the tunnel, and explosion, and they get into the little thing. She kicks down the door, and then because it's like a sappy moment, that she has the thing, boomer, and then the dog goes roar, and then leaps out of an explosion,
and with the flying motorcycle and the giant fireball.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Crime Lab gets out of danger, and he's saved from explosions by the alcove, which had a very interesting construction that was somehow very resilient against flames, which were rolling past it very quickly.
Yeah, she didn't close the door, did she?
Nope. It stayed wide open, and it just sort of just went whoosh.
I don't think that's how explosions work.
I don't think that's how doors work. But the something they had the whole thing happen.
Disclosure: I am not an explosionologist, and Joe is not a doorologist.
No, and but I am a wallologist, and I know that when Vivica A. Fox first leaps in there and hits her shoulder against the wall, that concrete wall shouldn't move. Which tells me that it's not concrete. So
back in college, you majored in wall and minored in alcoves.
Yes, well, I did a little mortar in between, but
holds everything together.
Yeah,
academically, of course.
Uh huh.
God.
Yes, I don't think God had anything to do with this. But all this stuff happens, and of course we've got Will Smith, and his whole NASA thing, and Harry Connick Jr., and it's like, well, if for some reason Harry Connick Jr. is a little weird,
and a little overly weird, a little stupid,
a little overly exuberant, and so there's a their conversation about NASA, and he got rejected again, and then he sees the ring box, and there's a little comedic moment where it looks like he's proposing to Will Smith, and the other guy's
pretty funny.
Yeah, and the other guy's like, oh, I didn't see anything, and he backs out of there, and it's like, LOL.
There's some funny writing in this. The cheesy moments that are added for levity to break up the seriousness actually work pretty well.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is your crack team of Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich writing this film. They wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Dean Devlin produced, and Roland Emmerich directed. And just like with Stargate, so that's why you get your cheese all over the place in this, and your giant plot holes.
Well, we can all agree on cheese.
Mm-hmm. And how? And they go through the whole rigmarole there, and they're going to launch an offensive, and blah 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 blah. And they fire the missiles, and it's not effective. Some sort of shield, blah 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 blah. Switch to Sidewinders from AMRAAMs. Oh no, they're also not effective because they're just Sidewinder missiles. And then there's alien fighters, which seems kind of, I don't know, pointless or sadistic. I'm not sure which, because there's no real reason to fear the fighter jets since they can't do anything. Unless it's something like on their 50th missile hit, then all of a sudden the shields come down or something. Like, I don't think that was a major concern that they had.
You think they should have just stayed there inside the shields looking out the window, like flipping them off or something?
Yeah, moon them. Although I'm not sure about the anatomy, if that's appropriate, but
I think they probably have butts.
They probably telepathically moon them, at least. They go through the whole
telepathically send a picture of their butt to somebody while they're flying a plane,
or at least the moon. And they saw it; they went right past it. There was the whole opening scene, Dan. So they
that opening scene, like, probably a little unnecessary. At least they get right into it. There's probably, it feels like 5 minutes of just shots of the moon and the dirt, and then all of a sudden there's a spaceship. But
well, I mean, that's to, you know, drive home the point that that's the furthest man has ever gone, and then here is a ship which has gone further than that, presumably, unless it started at the moon, which had been weird. But then it...
Because
it,
otherwise there would have been confusion as to whether or not it was a man-made spaceship.
Yes. No. Oh, no. And I forgot to mention earlier when we were talking about it, the briefing the president, that one government guy, I don't even know what branch of government he worked for, walks in with that steel case and he pops it open and it has that little like light pad thing that slides up, and it has like the little dials on the side, the number pad, and then it has like the backlit transparency of the radar printout. And I was just like, this is such an amazingly specific case to have. Like,
the development on that device probably cost like $500,000, and I don't know. I thought it was meant to look like an active display, like a screen or a laptop or something that would have an active update. But no, you're right. It was just a transparency, like a printout, a backlit printout of the radar scan.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to use that for? Oh, the president has X-rays. We better pop that thing open.
Well, like, we need to show somebody something that is very super top secret, and we need to transport it from place A to place B, and we need to make sure that if somebody intercepts it, they can't see the transparency.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be opaque about their transparencies.
Yes!
Opacity joke.
Mm.
It's all coming together.
That's what it's doing. It's what it's doing. All right. Speaking of coming together, some of our characters start to come together very shortly. There's the misguided attack. Harry Connick Jr. dies.
By the way, I just wanted to point it out. At least nobody like yelled out, "They have shields!" right before they all get slaughtered. So take note, Jurassic World writers.
No, actually, someone said they have a shield or something.
Yeah, like one person, but it wasn't the guys like flying around getting slaughtered.
Oh, okay. But what? I mean, one of the pilots said it.
You sure? You sure it wasn't one of the guys back in the control room when they fired the missile?
Yes, I thought it was one of the pilots.
Hmm.
Anyway, someone said it. It's a thing, and because obviously the audience doesn't know what a shield is, but it's only something they've seen in like Star Trek or Star Wars or anything. And given that some of the advertising for the film when it initially came out was this generation's Star Wars, and it's like, yeah, okay, great. My generation was still on Star Wars.
Did it actually say that?
Oh, I can't remember. I vividly remember someone saying that in like in a blurb for one of the ads, but I don't remember if it's something the movie said about itself or it was one of those like pull quotes from a review of somebody, like if it was like Pete Travers or some dumb stuff like that. But the anyway, they go through the whole thing here, and then all of a sudden they're in a canyon, which Los Angeles is famous for its canyons.
Yeah.
And they go through the whole thing, you know, Will Smith outsmarts the guy with the parachute thing and then jumps out, and then it crashes, and then Will Smith goes up to it and then, you know, punches him out and says, "Welcome to Earth." You know, thinking you all that, and you know, it was good stuff. Quite memorable and comedic. How punching that suit knocked out the alien in it, I don't understand exactly, but
Will Smith is very strong.
Yes. It's the power of Smith. So he was knocked out. And
I was more concerned with how he found the button to open the door.
Well, I thought the alien opened the door to come out.
Why would it do that?
Because it was in a crashed ship.
So?
I thought he was going to, like, attack him. Because you see all the tentacles were, like, flailing around and stuff?
When you call AAA, they tell you to stay in your car.
I don't think he called AAA.
I think he probably called Space AAA or whatever the equivalent would be to come get him.
Maybe.
Like, why would you get out of the vehicle? Especially if they have, like, tractor beams and stuff. Just stay in the vehicle.
I don't know, because maybe he could just kill him real quick. Although it was a huge miscalculation on his part, because he didn't realize he was up against Will Smith.
He's about to get punched in the mask.
Yes. The Fresh Prince took him out. And the...
he got in one little fight.
So, the fat lady sings and he smokes a cigar. And they
and don't forget, that's what I call a close encounter, because he's got to have two clever lines. Yes. Welcome to Earth, and that's what I call a close encounter.
Yes.
While he's chewing on his cigar.
Well, and there was also a previous reference to when he said, like, I don't think E.T. came down here to start a fight or whatever. So that's two Spielberg space movies for you at home.
Just eager to get up there and whoop E.T.'s ass.
Yeah, that's what it was. And they do the whole thing. And they he hauls the alien and, you know, has some very funny scenes later where he's shouting at it. Now, somehow he saw the base from the air of Area 51, because when he meets up with the trucks later, he says that. Again, I don't know how he flew from downtown Los Angeles to Arizona.
It's in New Mexico.
Well, it would have been through Arizona, though. California and New Mexico don't touch.
Right.
Yes.
So you're saying he threw... The canyon was the Grand Canyon, and then when they came flying out of the canyon, it was New Mexico?
I'm assuming that's what it had to be, because I don't know what other canyon that was supposed to be. I don't know how or why that alien was so tenacious to pursue him that long, and I don't know how or why Will Smith was able to dodge the alien for that long. Seemingly, the aliens are quite effective against literally everyone else in the film. So this just seems... It's just odd. It's very odd. But it's how our characters wind up meeting together. And then there's the... Russell gets out of jail from papering everyone with the downtown area and like Imperial, wherever they are in Imperial Valley, with leaflets about how they all need to leave. And so he tells the family to get all rounded up. They were already rounded up and leaving without him. So he comes along and they drive off in like their caravan of caravans off somewhere in the direction of Arizona and then New Mexico. And then we'll... later rendezvous with Will Smith.
Yeah, where were they? They were in farm territory.
It said Imperial Valley, California, initially.
Is that a thing?
Apparently.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. But
so I guess their cars are about as fast as a fighter pilot.
Mm-hmm. Well, or at least Air Force One, because Air Force One is also like, hey, you know where we should go? Area 51. Funny they should bring that up, because in the film, they have that scene where it's like, funny you should bring that up, because they start talking about nuking the alien ships. James Rebhorn's character, of Mr. Nimzicki, suggests nuking these ships, so that they have a strategic advantage and, you know, make it... persecutes the president for how he waited too long to act and how that's why they're in the situation. And there's a lot of shouting, and Jeff Goldblum's like, oh, well, you can't do that. You can't poison like Mother Earth and blah, 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 and blah, 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 stuff, radiation nukes. And they're like, oh, get him out of here. He doesn't know what he's talking about. How dare he be in here? And then Jed Hirsch comes in. He's like, you listen to my David, you knew and you did nothing, you know? And, this is the whole thing about, like, oh, I assure you, there is no Area 51. There are nothing like that. Blah, 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 blah. And then this Mr. Nimzicki, who used to be in the CIA, is like, well, Mr. President, it's not entirely true. And Judd Hirsch says, well, which part? And LOL, turns out there's an Area 51 and it has aliens. And Mr. Nimzicki didn't feel like bringing this up until this point in the film, because plausible deniability.
Of course.
Yeah.
You can play off pretty much anything in a movie by saying plausible deniability.
Yes. Well, so this plot hole is interesting. And they course correct so that they can go to Area 51. I don't know why specifically, because they're going to look at alien stuff that they have there. Doesn't really...
they'll probably have some answers there, right? You can go at least see what the enemy looks like.
Yeah, or you can at least meet interesting people, which they do. They meet a certain doctor.
Come on, out with it already.
Dan?
Yeah.
Do you know who they meet?
That one guy?
That one guy who?
Dr. Oaken?
And who is he played by, Dan?
Brent Spiner.
And who is Brent? What is Brent Spiner famous for?
He plays a guy with funny colored skin on Star Trek.
Dan.
Mm-hmm.
He's an android named Data.
I prefer iOS.
And he also plays Lore. And he also plays...
What's Lore?
Lore is another identical android to Data. But he's evil.
Does he have an android mustache?
No, he looks exactly the same. Only he can say can't, while Data says cannot. So that's how
you tell the two apart?
Yes, that is how Will Wheaton tells them apart in the episode Data Lore. I'm not making this up. This is all
no,
real.
No, I don't think you're making it up. It's just, it makes me sad.
Why does it make you sad, Dan?
It's horrible.
It's not horrible, Dan. It's space. The final frontier.
Which of the treks is he on?
The best of the treks. Star Trek The Next Generation. And Dan, do you know what else he's on? He was on Star Trek Enterprise, and he played a ancestor to the inventor of the androids that are in Star Trek The Next Generation, who was not necessarily a nice person.
Which one is the Professor Xavier Trek?
That's Star Trek The Next Generation.
Okay. I can't keep him straight.
Damn. All right, so they meet Dr. Oaken, who is...
kind of a wackadoodle.
Very wackadoodle. And
he's funny, though. He's actually one of the more interesting characters in the movie.
Socially awkward, says the wrong stuff, seems to be very focused on his particular line of work. So there's that. And he's very cautious about revealing the information, which seems a little stupid at this point. It's just like, just show everybody everything. So he's like, oh, you guys... want to see it? You want to see the vault? And so they, you know, go down there. And he's like, they call it the vault, or as we call it, the freak show. And then he opens up the cylinders, and there's alien things floating, and he talks about how they died in the crashes and stuff. And he's like, well, you know, they're very frail and fragile, blah, 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 blah. Important information. And this is around the time that Will Smith arrives with the dead one, and they take it downstairs. And they're like, oh, we got to operate on it and see if it's still alive and poke it with stuff. And
we didn't get a clear idea of why they were taking it into surgery.
No, I don't know if they're trying to save it or just vivisect it or what their plan was here. I mean, because they're vivisecting the biological suit, because the biological suit isn't dead. But it's very strange, because also they decided, you know what we don't need here? Security guys. None. Not a single one.
They were still in the other room taking the tour.
Yeah, because you know what you got to do? Not have any security officers around your alien in his power armor, like alien exoskeleton.
Well, it's okay. He was unconscious. He was unconscious.
Yes, and that'll last forever. That's how it always lasts. So that didn't work. And you get the nice shot of like the nicotating membrane thing sliding back over the metal eye, and you know the. Like cricket noise as it sort of penetrates into Dr. Oaken's mind, and then kills everybody, and flailing and crashing and screaming and stuff. So that all works out well for the alien. Then they're like, oh, maybe we should go talk to the doctor and check on him and stuff. And they go down there, and then the doctor is very suspiciously slammed against the wall with a bunch of foggy stuff behind him. And the doctor is talking in a weird,
that's
raspy...
That's what all surgeries look like, isn't it?
Yeah.
Foggy stuff?
Yeah, he's talking in a weird, raspy, echoey voice. And he's like, release me. And then, you know, dipshit Adam Baldwin is like, hey, I'm going to go do what he says and open the door. And the guy's like, hold on a second. Wait. Don't do that.
How did he make it all the way to Major and still be that stupid?
I don't know. Well, he's Adam Baldwin. Gamer Gator infamous Adam Baldwin is in this film with slightly more hair than he has later on in his life. But it's a very strange haircut, too. And they're like, oh, so Now that we've stopped Adam Baldwin from accidentally opening the doors like a moron, let's all stand here and chit-chat with this alien creature that has its tentacle wrapped around Brent Spiner's neck and seems to be talking through him. You know, they it's like, you know, peace, there be no peace. What do you want from me? Die. And then there's like the crickety noise, and he's like penetrating the president's mind, and it's like, oh no, what did we do? And then, of course, Robert Loggia is like, is that glass bulletproof? No, sir. And then they start shooting it up, and then the alien goes flying across the room.
Yeah, this is where things start to go a little off the rails. Because the alien gets in the president's head for some reason, and then all of a sudden the president, it's not so much like he's trying to control him. They just meld minds for a moment, and the president can see all of their plans and all of their history of everything that they have ever done.
Yeah, he's like the Bond villain of aliens. Let me explain my evil plan to you mentally.
Like, let me telepathically drop all of the exposition right into your head so you can tell everyone.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, you know, everyone in the audience is wondering why they're doing this, and they had to get an answer from somewhere. Although I find this is an unsatisfying trajectory to receive this answer from a telepathic mind meld death thing.
I saw their plans. I saw what they're going to do.
They're like locusts. They move from one planet to the next. Ugh, God, so stupid. But
well, we did get the important plot point in this, that it is the entire civilization on this ship that is moving from one planet to another. That is important to know, that, you know, you blow up the ships, they're all done. You don't have to worry about the wormhole opening up again and Thanos coming through with another set of aliens.
Yeah, or with the Goa'uld, but that's a different thing. So they do this stuff here where they're like, yeah, let's go ahead and nuke the bastards. Which probably sounded like a good idea at the time.
Not really.
No, but because it's like, hey, you know what? I bet we'll get through these shields, nukes, because they're like the most powerful thing we have, right? Yeah, let's fire one of them. Okay. How much does everybody like Houston? Not a whole lot. Okay, let's blow up Houston.
That's what I was going to say. All else fails. It's just Houston.
Yeah, well, they make a couple excuses. They're like, everybody's deserted the major cities at this point. So the aliens, apparently, I guess, are just blowing up major cities so nobody has anything to run back to or something. I don't know.
It's about the infrastructure. You blow up, you know, the heads of all the credit card buildings, you erase the debt record.
Wow.
Maybe the aliens had a lot of mortgages, and they wanted that erased.
That's why they keep moving. They're evading the creditors.
They just let their planet get foreclosed and then move on to a new planet.
Well, they charge the cost of a planet to the next planet. You know, it's just like with credit cards. You just keep getting a new credit card and you put all of your balance onto your next credit card.
Yeah, they transfer the balance because you get 12 months no interest, right? So they just transfer the dead planet to the new planet with no interest for a little while.
Yeah, all of this is great. This is working really well.
This is space economics, Joe.
Mm-hmm. This is space economics 101.
I think we're probably a little closer to 201.
Oh. So are we ready to balance checkbooks now? Are we really ready to balance space checkbooks? All right, everybody, take out your register.
It's all about space checks and balances.
So
when we're done talking about this, we should speculate on what the second and third movies are going to be.
Oh, God, I have no idea. Independence Day 2 resurgence? Goodness only knows. I mean, maybe, what's-her-face, Imitation Katniss will show up, and then she'll be in there. It'll be like Divergent Resurgence, Invergence, whatever. And they can do their thing.
What?
Remember Divergent and Insurgent?
Yeah.
And this next one's called Resurgence for the Independence Day. I was making a joke about.
Oh, I was looking at the young daughters in Independence Day. I'm like, which one do they screw up to be in Divergent?
Oh, never mind.
Thankfully, none of them. Mae Whitman's in this. Mae Whitman's in this.
Mm-hmm.
She plays somebody with the last name Whitmore, which is very close.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's the daughter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She was in Scott Pilgrim.
Mm-hmm.
She's good.
Mm-hmm.
She should be in the second one.
That would be interesting. Somehow they got Bill Pullman to agree to do it, so there's that.
What do you mean somehow?
I don't know. Like, he's not in a lot of stuff these days.
That's exactly my point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily his fault or if he's just selective. Let's just say he's selective. So they go through all of this rigmarole with the stuff and the things, and they, you know, they nuke the Houston area. They get visual confirmation that did Jack Diddley. They decide that was not really a great plan. They're going to rethink that. They're going to put a pin in that one, put that in the parking lot. And they...
put a nuke in the parking lot?
Yeah, yes, put a nuke in the parking lot. And around this time, Will Smith decides he needs to go back to El Toro to look for Jasmine. And he goes and he does that, and he brings back the president. The president's the first lady who the Jasmine had collected along with a couple other people. Who she managed to save in her truck that she got with the conveniently located keys. I don't know why anyone keeps their keys in a visor in Los Angeles. That doesn't seem like a thing people should do.
They did it in Terminator. What was it? Terminator 2, actually. So, you know, I'm willing to go with it.
All right. Well, sure. It was only 4 years previous to this, so nobody learned their lesson.
It was a simpler time. People trusted their Los Angeles fellow residents, and they just left their keys in the car.
No one did. So they go through this whole thing, and they Will Smith rescues them, and they, you know, take the helicopter ride back to Area 51. I don't quite know the distance of that helicopter he took
from Los Angeles to New Mexico.
Yeah. Well, no, from New Mexico to Los Angeles and back to New Mexico.
Right, right.
Without refueling. So,
well, it was a big helicopter, wasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it can do that thing. So, it did.
I did like that line where the guy pulled the gun on him, told him to get out of the helicopter, and he said, "Just tell him I hit you." That was funny.
Yeah, and the guy like does the face.
Like, he clearly has 150 pounds on Will Smith.
Yeah, yeah. And so they do the whole thing, and he rescues them and rescues the first lady, who unfortunately dies. And there's a very somewhat, I think, moving scene with the wife as she dies. So that's sad, you know, President Laura Roslin dying. So, you know, Bill Pullman tells the daughter, like, "Oh, mommy's sleeping now." And she's like, "Oh, sleeping?" It's like, "Yep." And it's like, "Oh, such a terrible liar, Bill Pullman." Not amazing at the acting either. But so they do that thing.
Is there a reason she had to die?
For tension stuff? I don't know.
I mean, like, it's not really. Like, the president's already super, like, feeling guilty about the fact that he didn't evacuate the cities quick enough and a bunch of people died on his watch. So, do they really need to kill his wife?
Well, I think they needed to kill somebody in sort of the main-ish cast of people, because otherwise there wasn't really like a lot of gravity to it, because the people who had died so far we had known for maybe 5 minutes tops in the running length of the film. So...
because we really knew her a whole lot better?
Well, we didn't know much about her, but she had been in more scenes for a longer duration of the film.
Barely.
Well, no. She had probably as much screen time as Harvey Fierstein did, or as much screen time as Harry Connick Jr. did, but it was just stretched out over a longer length of the film. Like, they cut to her a couple times. And so she was still around for quite a ways into the film until after they got to Area 51, unlike these other people. So, you know, it's just another person to die. But whatever. Like, maybe she could have survived or, you know, had something horrible but not deadly happen to her. Who knows? There's that. She's not going to be in the sequel, though. Spoiler alert. Oh, maybe she's resurgent. Who knows? So they go through the whole...
My gosh.
It's all zombies.
They use the alien exoskeleton and combine it with her body and create sort of a human alien hybrid.
Yuck. Kill me. Different movie. So they do the whole thing, and they decide, hey, you know what? Jeff Goldblum's very drunk right now, and he needs to get off the floor or else he'll catch a cold. Hey, you know what's like a cold? A virus. Do you know what's like a virus? An alien computer. So,
and now we get into the second part of this movie that is just completely ridiculous.
Yeah, like where the first part of this film, there are moments that strain credulity in terms of like believing in what's happening in the film in its own, by its own laws, like the world that it's building. We have to believe that these things are happening within it. By the time we get to this point in the film, like we, you know, like you're just on this popcorn ride, people. So they decide they have a computer virus, and they're going to use the computer virus that they just whipped up in the lab on the alien mothership. And there's a very dramatic demonstration of the alien computer virus where Jeff Goldblum asks Major Mitchell to shoot the Coke can off of the alien spaceship, and it ricochets and luckily didn't kill anyone. This is not a good demonstration technique. go and they shoot again, and oh, it was, you know, knocked off because the shields are down because we used a computer virus. So what we got to do is upload this to the mothership, and then it'll go to all the other alien ships, and then we'll blow up the mothership with a nuke, and then everything will go great. And we'll use this one ship in order to go ahead and do all that. And then everyone in the who's remotely sane in the film says, this is not really a good plan. It seems bonkers. And the president's like, tell me more.
Well, there's a ticking clock because as soon as they come up with this plan, like one of the ships starts coming towards Area 51 to blow them all up for some reason and apparently knew they were there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they blew up NORAD. It's not like they necessarily would care about where NORAD is for any population density reason. It was also weird that when the tractor trailers ran away in Imperial Valley, they're like, the alien ship's coming this way. It's like, the alien ship's going to blow up Imperial Valley? Like, with the tractor trailers? Like, do they have something against this? Like, wouldn't it make more sense to, I don't know, blow up San Francisco or something? Like, what are you doing, guys?
Well, rural farming really is the backbone of our economy, and if you take that out, the human race is basically done. I think that's how it works.
Sure. Well, flying through space ain't like dusting crops, boy. So they go ahead and they brief some new trainee pilots on how to fly their brand new little ships that they don't have pilots for. So they're just like, hey guys, so this is how we're going to give you a crash course, pardon my pun, in how to fly. Yeah, it did not deliver well. And how to fly these more modern aircraft from what you're used to. This is probably not the level of training that would be deemed sufficient.
Necessary, but not sufficient. And they've got a throttle and a stick, and that's all you need, right?
Mm-hmm. And so they go through this, and Russell gives this whole spiel about how he wants to go blow up the aliens because he was abducted by aliens. And then somehow someone did go, hey, we should replace him with, like, literally anyone else. And so he gets to go. And the president gives a stirring speech about stuff. And it's a nice speech. It's a very America-centric speech, but it is sort of an optimistic speech about the whole world will stand together on this day. But it's kind of like the whole world led by America kind of a thing. And
we're not self-centered at all.
No, nothing in this movie is self-centered about America.
Because there's also that montage right around the same time where they're like Morse coding around the planet to everyone who's just kind of sitting there waiting for something to happen. And it goes, oh, the Americans have figured it out and here's what we're going to do. Let's just follow what they say. Whereas it would probably be more like these guys are full of it.
Well, it's actually kind of funny because the Morse code as a trope in science fiction is quite hilarious because it comes up in all sorts of strange circumstances where it's just like, this is not an efficient nor effective way to communicate with other people. It's not really encrypted in any specific way that would be useful. The technology for communicating in this manner it requires those little clicky things. Like, do they have those in a storage closet? Like,
also require like an actual hardwire connecting the sender and the receiver?
No, you can do it over radio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But you have to do all this. You do need those little clicky things, or at least some other things that can do it. But they happen to have the little clicky things, which raises the question of, was that like in a filing cabinet? Like, where did they get those? But they go through this whole thing, and then all of the other people around the world happen to have them. And fortunately for us, they're all very easy to grok stereotypes about the regions that they're from. So there's that. Roland Emmerich, about as subtle as Paul Verhoeven sometimes. Most of the time, all the time. And so they do that whole thing of, oh, the whole world is behind us. China is not mentioned in this movie, just so you know. None of that happens. There's Japan. What was it? Germany or Russia? And then...
Was there a France in there?
No. And there was a Iraqi desert with the British guys and the Israeli guys. And anyway, they go through the whole thing. It's all about the world working together, whatever. And the Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith are going on their little trip, and there's some tension between the two of them over whether or not they can do their thing. And it's like, well, you think you can really fly that thing? Do you think you can really do all that bullshit you just said? Which is funny.
But before we find out if they can really do all that bullshit they just said, can I ask you a philosophical question about spaceship shields?
Okay.
So the bullet could not penetrate the shield, but he could walk up and set a Coke can down with the shield still turned on. So
no, it wasn't on.
So do you have to turn the shields off before you get in the ship?
Yes.
Okay, so... do we presume then that the shields have been off the entire time? So nothing goes in and out of the shields at all when they're on, right?
As far as I know.
Okay. Because it seems...
We never see anything go in and out of the shields when they're on. The alien fighters leave the mothership and theoretically pass through where the shields are, but I don't know if they turn them off in a region or something, but... Yeah.
I suppose it's advanced enough that you could turn them off in just a particular region, because it just seemed to me that it was... selective as to what could and could not go through the shield. So bullets and missiles and airplanes, no. Jeff Goldblum with a Coke can, yes. So,
but I think he turned it off before he put the Coke can.
Okay, just checking. Because, okay. I mean, before he came up with the virus, if they were to try to do a similar demonstration, how would they have, like, touched the ship?
I think it was off. Because they had control over whether or not it was on.
I thought it was on by default and the virus was the only thing that turned it off. So as soon as they boot up the ship, it would be immediately on.
That did not come across for me.
I don't understand how space shields work.
Well, neither does anybody in this movie. So that works out well.
I figured you would, since you have an extensive background in space shields.
But those are Star Trek space shields. So it's totally different, Dan.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
How do theirs work?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Most of the time, a shield can prevent teleportation with transporter devices through the shield. However, in some cases, you can transport one direction from inside of a ship through their own shield down to a planet's surface. However, you can't transport people back up that way. You have to lower your shields in order to do that. However, in a few episodes of Star Trek, there were actually some plot holes where they weren't able to transport in either direction. So there's that. But... the other thing about them is that they can get down to like 10%, but it's like 10% all over. It's like, doesn't make any sense as a metric. Like, you'd think it would like go down in one spot or the other.
Does 10% of shields mean it protects 10% as well, or they're just 10% of the energy powering it, so it's still almost at full strength, but it'll run out soon?
I'm glad you asked. That's my answer, because I don't know. Those are the same questions that I raise, especially like in Voyager. They would talk about structural integrity is down to 10% all the time. It's like, what the F does that mean? Like, the ship's going to like fly apart in like 10% of the places, or like it's like micro fractures on the hull. It's like, what's going on, you guys? Come on. Anyway, so minor digression. Shields are just advanced, and they prevent things. And so you get around them with things, or you shoot them until they're not there anymore for reasons. The end. And that's what they do in this movie, is they get around it with their advanced know-how and Max.
With their cold.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't see what he was writing. Was he writing Bash? Was it a little Perl?
No, it had brackets and parentheses, so it was some sort of, like, I don't know, C, Pascal, whatever. I don't know what it was going, but it was stuff like alien virus, execute Jolly Roger. It was nonsense gibberish. And not to say that, the least of which, the progress bar for uploading alien virus is suitably ludicrous. As well as understanding the graphics drivers for what would necessarily present a Jolly Roger image on the alien vessel also doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Because while they did have the ship since the 50s, Dr. Oaken had said that nothing turned on till the aliens got there, because they didn't have a way to duplicate the alien power source. And somehow the alien mothership transmits power to the other ships, including, like, shields and stuff. It doesn't make a lot of sense, really, if you think about it, because then how did that ship get there to begin with? Because it didn't come there with a mothership, it came there by itself, so then it had its own power source, but then it turned off, but now it can work on this backup power source? I don't know how it works. So they call for jumper cables or something, but they take their little ship up into space, yes, without the oops, and they fly through, and, you know, this is Will Smith's character's dream to be in space as an astronaut. And then,
as noted by that 5 seconds of discussion about that letter he got from NASA.
Yes. It was really important to him for those 5 seconds. And then at this part, and then they go fly through the, triangle hole in the whale shark ship. And the, inside of it is a very V'ger like, which is a Star Trek reference. And they fly around, and there are aliens that are lining up to get on ships to go down as part of an invasion force. And again, that doesn't really make a whole ton of sense, because I don't know why you would, like, go from exterminating humans from afar to let's send foot soldiers, because how is that effective, really? We've seen those, which we've saw at least one of them in combat. It did not go well.
Also, they're in their little exoskeleton suits, but are we to assume that is basically their equivalent of a space suit? Because they've kind of got an open window out to space there, and it didn't seem like there was an atmosphere on the inside there, and they supposedly breathe oxygen.
No, there's all that cloudy stuff, Dan.
Oh, is that the floating atmosphere that is somehow held in place with the force field?
I'm assuming. I don't know. I it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. Like, that's not the part that bothers me. All the other stuff with, like, they dock with the alien thing and then close the power windows and the alien doesn't think this is suspicious, and then they try to leave and it doesn't budge, and then the alien thinks it's suspicious, and then they send the investigation ships. Nobody, like, walks over to it or anything. Like, it's weird. And then, you know, they upload an alien computer virus to the mothership. But they do their thing. And
it's a good thing he was able to hack the Wi-Fi password.
Yes. Well, I mean,
negotiating with the host.
Yeah, they could have had free Wi-Fi, though, you know?
I mean, why wouldn't you?
For customers.
Yeah, you want to have free Wi-Fi in your waiting area.
Yeah.
It really keeps people calm.
Yeah, at least in the lobby. I mean, I'm sure, like, after a certain time, you got to sign in and be like, yes, guest in room 5033 or whatever. But this is, you know, it's just common courtesy. Provide Wi-Fi, make people happy. You get fewer customer complaints. And so they, you know, upload with their Mac to the alien computer with their progress bar. And, like...
Wait, sorry. Did Macs have Wi-Fi in 1996?
No, they, I don't know, used whatever the alien transmitter thing was on the thing, of the thing. I have no idea. I don't know what the interface is. There was just, like, a bundle of wires that fell out of the back of that Mac.
Well, there was that radio transmitter thing that they installed in the bottom of the ship, which was apparently both for communicating with Earth and the ship.
No, that was just for communicating with Earth.
No. Well, yeah. then I got nothing.
Yeah, I have no idea. So they did
it
their
thing.
It
was tethering to the ship's Wi-Fi.
They uploaded the thing, and then the ships go to engage, and there's that big dramatic moment, and, aw, shucks, the shield was still up. And then the president's like, I want another crack at it. Why?
He's a tenacious one, that president.
Yeah, well, he's not going to be told what to do. So he goes and he shoots again, and it lands. And then rather stupidly, they say, fire at will. Don't fire at will. Let me tell you guys what you do. You fire at the bay doors where their fighter jets come out of. You stupid idiots, blow up the doors, because then they can't get their fighters out to you. Just melt those things, glass it. I don't understand that battle strategy. Just like fire at random like windows. Like you're probably just blowing up all the saunas. Like who knows what you're hitting? It's like you have an intricate diagram of where everything is. You know where the door opens and all the alien fighter ships come out of though.
Well, you didn't hear that like piece of news footage in the background where they apparently it was unanimously agreed upon that the part with the little indent and the little vertical bit was the front of the ship.
Well, yeah, but that's just the front. And the fighter part was a little strip along that thing. So blow that up. Specifically that.
They don't have as much experience with space battles as you do, Joe.
You don't need experience with space battles. You need like experience with like a first-person shooter or a boss battle in a Nintendo game. I mean, come on, guys. And so they stupidly just like fire at random stuff all over the giant 13 mile wide ship, and then that's not really having enough of an effect and we're running out of missiles, go figure. And then the alien weapon is going to engage and it's going to blow up.
I like
up
how
stuff.
Their only options are literally nukes or just those little missiles that are on the planes. Like what happened to all of the other military artillery that would have been in between?
Yeah, like ICBMs, all the other stuff, all the great missiles. But they go ahead and they do all this stuff, and then the weapon starts to open, and they're like, oh, hey, I got an idea. What if we blow up the main weapon? It's full of, like, energy and stuff. Maybe that'll do things. So they go and they try to start to do that when they, you know, have almost no missiles left. And then the last person who has missiles, of course, is Russell Kay. And big dramatic music moment. He comes in, he's going to do his thing. The, thing's locked and oh no, what are they going to do? And he's like, tell my kids I love them. And he does the sort of like honorable thing of sacrificing himself, and the, you know, dime store Keanu Reeves like, no, dad, no. And, the ship.
How stupid would he have felt if that didn't actually do anything?
Oh man, that would have sucked. Could you imagine? It was just like plunk. Then that would have been really sad, but fortunately for him and for the audience, who probably figured that it would do something, it blew up the ship rather spectacularly. And there's this really nice moment of the all the windows blowing out from the inside, all the fire coming out of them. All that stuff's nice. And you know, I question how it hung there in the air necessarily before sort of slowly drifting to the side so as not to crush Area 51 under it, but to rather split apart in half and then like land in two different chunks, like a little further away in that map painting we see later. That was an interesting method of disbursement for your 13 mile wide ship, but they did it. You know, the Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith are like, time to light up the cigars. We're gonna fire the missile.
They can't escape the clutches of the ship. They might as well at least take out the mothership while they have the ability.
Yeah, and then they shoot it, and it goes through a couple walls and puppets, and then the
it smashes the one alien in the control room that was apparently the one that locked them up. So, you know, of course they're loose now because that's how electronics work.
Yes. Well, you see, it was tied to a pressure-sensitive cable that ran through that wall that they destroyed. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I think they call that fly-by-wire.
Yeah. And so they flew. And then the alien fighter jets are like, we're coming after you. And then they're like, we're dodging, because they can. And they fly out of there, and they're all the ships that are leaving with all the troops, and they weave out of there, and then the triangle door is closing, and they squeeze out at the last minute. It's very tense.
Must go faster.
Yes, yes.
For the second time in 2 years.
You're obsessed with the fat lady. And then the nuke in the missile, which has part of a faceplate knocked off of it now so that we can see the counter, so that the alien can see the counter. Not that the alien necessarily understands counting in the human language, but maybe it does.
And it kind of looks like the alien is trying to, like, control the bomb with ESP to, like, try and stop it.
Yeah, it has, like, a little, like, frog croak. Like, what?
He's got his shiny eyes out, and he's making some noises like he was trying to do his ESP thing.
Yes, yes. He's like, hey, stranger, haven't seen you in this part of the ship before. You look mighty fine. Oh, what is that? You say you're a bomb? Oh, that's interesting. Kaboom! And so the ship blows up, and there's a very dramatic, big energy wave and pieces of ship rock things that are flying really fast. And then Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith get caught up in it. No, what happens to our heroes? They're fine.
Stay tuned.
They're totally fine. And so, you know, Connie and Vivica Fox and Bill Pullman and Legia and everybody, they're just like, oh, we did it. We saved the day. Now we, you know, we're all going to hang out here. And, oh, something came down. No word from them, but it could be them. Let's all drive out in a Jeep together.
And let's all stand up on the seats up over top of the windscreen in as dramatic a way as possible, but very dangerous for catching rocks and bugs in the face.
Yeah, it doesn't, it's stupid. So they go ahead and they do their thing. And then the whole thing works out okay, because guess what? Walking out of the crashed ship is a smiling Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith, and they're like, hey, hi, yeah, hurrah, and they're fine. And there's hugging and kissing, and I told you there'd be fireworks and debris.
And cigars.
And cigars, yes, yes. He's like, I could get used to this. And Connie's like, oh, no, LOL.
Because, you know, they made up at Will Smith's wedding, which we kind of glossed over.
Oh, yeah.
He used his dolphin ring to get married to his wife.
Yeah, I didn't really care about the wedding.
No. I mean, it was, I guess, a nice gesture before he went off to space.
Yeah. So I'm sure it's so that she can get his Social Security from the totally functioning government.
Right, right. You know, God forbid anything happened to him. She needs to be able to get that pension check.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm sure that the government is working like a well-oiled machine. And they'll have the wedding on file, and they'll have with the witnesses that signed off on it in Area 51, in the the chaplain there, like all totally normal stuff.
Do you think the wedding is deemed classified?
I'm not sure exactly how that's going to shake out. We'll find out in the sequel, I bet.
if an Area 50 wedding, if an Area 51 wedding falls in the woods, does anyone hear it?
Oh, it can't fall in the woods. It's in the desert, Dan.
Hmm. Hmm. Salt flats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, sands through an hourglass, so are the weddings of our deserts.
That one was better. I like that one.
Anything else, or you wanna nuke this?
I like this movie. Mm-hmm. I thought it was funny that when Goldblum boots up his Mac, it has a HAL 9000 screensaver that says "Hello, Dave," or "Good morning, Dave," or whatever.
Yeah, good morning, nice. Dave.
It's a good movie. It's very 1996. It's well made, though. It's a little slow at times, and like you pointed out, there are some moments where we decide to slow down and get really sentimental and emotional. I think Will Smith says goodbye to Vivica for what, like, 5 minutes before he even like shows up at the army base. They have a very touching send off, like as if they were never going to see each other, which takes way too long, but that's fine. There are a few of those moments in the movie, but it's good. It's well done. Mm-hmm. Aside from hacking the aliens with a computer cold and signals in the satellites, it's actually relatively believable characters doing sort of believable things.
Yeah, I think it's really like the tension, the action, and the characters that carry the film, and not the plot or the plans of the aliens or the world building of how the aliens work or any of that stuff. If that is the sort of thing that interests you in these sorts of films, you are going to be greatly disappointed by something like this. But given the fact that this is an incredibly old film, a 19-year-old film, you've already probably been disappointed by it. So congratulations. And given that it's you know, past Independence Day already, you probably already saw it. Aha! Again! Aha! On cable, with like a watermark thing in the bottom, and they bleeped all the words.
Yeah, I guess the plot of this movie is very easy to summarize. It's surprisingly few things happen in this movie. I mean, if you were to just condense it down, you know, like aliens show up, they blow up all the major cities, the last humans rally together to try and fight the ships. They lose one round. They figure out how to hack the code into the mothership. They do that, and then they blow them all up. Like that's pretty much the gist of it. There's like two battles. They lose one and they win one.
So what? So
and it all happens over 3 days? 2 days?
I think the opening title card to the film is July 2nd.
Yeah. So
yeah,
2 or 3 days worth of stuff.
Yep. I can't help but think though about how the second one's gonna come out, because you can't make a movie in this style and in this fashion these days, or at least Roland Emmerich hasn't in this style or in this fashion. So I'm curious to find out what he chooses to prioritize for when he's telling the tale for that sequel. It's like, is it going to be this sort of like a jam full but still kind of lean thing, or is it going to be, you know, a total like bloated monstrosity full of like cut corners and stuff like we kind of expect these days?
Would you like to hear what the plot summary is on IMDb
of the second one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, spoiler alert, listeners, fast forward like 30 seconds.
Spoiler alert to this thing that was written by 20th Century Fox and put on the internet. Using recovered alien technology, the nations of Earth have collaborated on an immense defense program to protect the planet, but nothing can prepare us for the aliens' advanced and unprecedented force. Only the ingenuity of a few brave men and women can bring our world back from the brink of extinction. So, basically the same thing, but we're going to fight aliens with alien technology.
Well, they have all the stuff from the first film.
Sure. I mean, I figure they can probably a little duct tape and super glue and put the ships back together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the interfaces are all completely human compatible.
Yeah, they couldn't replicate the alien power source, so I'm sure they got right on that.
William Fichtner's in it. He's good.
Oh, okay.
And Liam Hemsworth, apparently.
Oh. I prefer Chris.
Yeah. He should just show up as Thor.
Liam?
Oh, no, Chris. Guess who's in this?
Bill Pullman.
And?
Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
Will Smith.
I don't see him listed. Judd Hirsch is here, but guess who's going to be in it apparently that you said wouldn't be in it?
Mary McDonnell?
Your Star Trek boy, he's in it.
Oh, but he's dead.
Yeah, I know. I told you, they bring him back. They put him in the thing to make a... They rebuild him with alien parts. Oh, no, I said that about the first lady, didn't I? Never mind.
Yeah.
Maybe they did it with both of them.
Maybe they put them together in a chimera. Ugh. It's an unpleasant thought. So.
Half doctor, half first lady?
Yuck. Yuck, yuck. Gross.
That's great. It starts with a. Snakes, an airplane, Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane, listen to yourself, turn world, serve its own needs, dummy, serve your own needs, beat it up and not speak grunt.